When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take it.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard. And holy hot damn, are we rolling into the end of this movie. We're deep inside the Airport Hilton in LA, and one of the guests has both been deep inside maybe a guest of the LA Hilton, but has been deep inside the LA Hilton at least twice in his time traveling between Australia and the City of Stars. I'm Blake Howard, your host. Joining me again and just racking up their guest appearances, and I might make them promise they've got to come back because I know that after the 166th minute when Michael Mann comes on the show, there's really two out of three people that I can really think of that I would need on the show are sitting in front of me right now. One of them is Mr. Garth Franklin, who's done our web design and is also in the Woodward and Bernstein Washington Post level 21-year-old movie news website, Dark Horizons, the highest level of movie news integrity that exists on the internet. That legend is in front of me. And also one thick, girthy arm of the tripod of the Cinephiles podcast and the man who really like grabbed me in the face Al Pacino Any Given Sunday style and wrangled me into doing this podcast, Mr. Stu Coote. Welcome back to the show, gentlemen.
So if you put our introductions together, we have penetration and girth. It's not a bad night out of
that. It's very useful.
Yeah.
Not a bad night.
Not... Aren't we meant to like come here? He first.
Literally.
First, he begs us to be on the show. He can't get a single guest lately.
No one
wants to be on his little well, show. Yeah. Begs us.
I got the messages.
Stu, no one wants to be on my show. Please. Please, you know Garth, put in a good word for me.
That's it. And we take out so much serious time out of our day.
Exactly.
This sort of stuff. And then we get here and then we get shackled to the wall and then it becomes a whole lot.
In fairness, we brought the shackles.
Yeah.
They were fluffy.
They were
fluffy.
Microfiber.
And then on top of that, he's like, once I get Michael Mann on... You guys can do the episode after.
Great, thanks. We'll walk on after that.
We'll pick up the pieces.
it's like going on a date with someone after they just dated Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry. I'm just not.
Yeah. Are you in the mood for the rest? Because here I am.
Hey, they call me Luke and the other one.
No, it's good to be back. No, it's good. It's always a pleasure to come around.
Yes, indeed.
On with the show. No, it's good. It's good to be here. We've had some fun of late. So.
It's been a good blast, this whole journey.
It has. We are very much... It's only when we were sort of looking at what's sort of on the screen and it's coming, I'm like, oh, wow, we are...
We are really like towards the end, yeah.
We have come a ways.
Yeah.
From first recording up in the... We've been like...
In a hotel room that we're...
Yeah, we've been all over the place. But yeah, it's been a journey.
The fact that it's also... We've given our friend something way too much to concentrate on for probably the past 2 years. Yeah. And he's
only
taken
few,
that ball
only
and run
few
with
things
it.
Have happened in my personal life in the last 2 years that really registered anyway. What
but you've second. Taken that ball and you've run with it so far.
Yeah.
Way further than we were expecting.
Yeah, well, I had odds. I'll be honest. Yeah. In the pool.
Oh, yeah.
You had 11 episodes. I was 7. And I was in the first 3.
Yeah.
So go figure.
You thought that was going to be a certainty of it crashing.
I was trying to tank myself. Look how it's blown up in my face. Someone's going to run away with the pot.
Oh, man. It's when I see the scenes and, you know, and I see the schedule of guests and I see the scenes and I think about it, I just go, Jesus, like it just was, it's an all-consuming, but in the very best way, an all-consuming thing.
Oh, hell of a ride.
Oh, yeah. Man. I could never have imagined it. So if you guys are, if this is your first episode of One Heat Minute,
If you're listening at 150 what minutes in, you're fucked.
Yeah. Actually, if that is you, stop listening. We don't want you listening. You don't deserve it. Unless, if that is you and you do turn off, go back and listen to all the 149 episodes. Hit me up on Twitter, @stu_watches, and tell me you've listened. Then it's okay.
Okay.
It's a very specific criteria we give first-time listeners.
And if someone's taking this for, like, some sort of important recording to, like, vet or whatever, this sort of this series...
We won't hear.
Probably not. Try skipping to something else.
There's some other great episodes with more reputable guests.
Yeah. That's not hard to find.
Much more informed, much more intelligent than we us.
I mean, look, if the list of people in front of you maintains, you know, you're following... Academy Award nominated filmmaker and editor Luke Doolin. You're also following AFI/actor and Logie Award winning actor Henry Nixon.
Logie.
You're following.
Don't let me tell you how many Logies Dark Horizons has.
Oh, look, I won a swimming participation medal.
There you go.
Really impressive.
Really impressive. You're also following Matt Zollerzeitz, editor at large.
Glad we know that after we signed on.
I'm more proud of the fact that I finally got Matt Zollerzeitz to follow me after I made some joke about Seabiscuit being well hung.
So off brand for you.
I know.
How did you? What made you stray into such troubled waters?
I don't know
waters?
How I got into that area. It was a difficult thing.
Oh, jeez. But so here we are. I mean, it's so crazy because there was a couple of... And for folks who are listening, there's like a couple of episodes that I recorded on this show very early. Really early, in fact. The 137th and 38th episodes, which hopefully you've listened to with Luke Doolin and Henry Nixon, were recorded around the time I did like a big proof of concept recording with these lovely gentlemen sitting in front of me. And when I did it, I kind of like banked it away in my head and I was like, I don't ever know if I'm going to reach them. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, I don't know if I'm ever going to, if it's ever going to actually eventuate. And I eventually, as you know, hopefully if you're listening, you've heard like me talk through those episodes and put them together as a bonus episode because I just wasn't sure if you guys would ever get to hear them. So I'm like, I'm going to release them at some point and thank Luke and
Henry
for their participation. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
But now that we're here, I'm like, wow, not only am I there, but we are beyond those episodes.
Not only are you there, you're doing bonus episodes of other movies to go and just to go and say how not heated.
And not particularly good movies.
That you spend the time on that, you could have done three of your own episodes. You're a madman.
Yeah. Well, look, that was Katie Walsh. Mm. And Katie, a friend of the show, she was so much fun to talk to that it was almost... It was a knee-jerk reaction. I was like, it might be too much fun to not have this conversation and record it.
Yeah.
And I had a great... And I'm hoping you guys had a great time. I hope the filmmakers understand. And by the time you've listened to this episode, which is 151, Mr. Cam Williams, who's an Australian film writer around many places, he heard on the ABC. You occasionally might see him on Birth Movies Death is recently his haunt. And he's on Twitter way too much. And he coined a phrase, which I'm going to let you boys in on, which I think is perfectly appropriate. He called it heat blocking. So his phrase heat blocking or heat blockers means that if you're a filmmaker who goes out there and you say that your movie is influenced or inspired by heat, you have just heat blocked your movie, meaning that that movie is going to be a steaming pile of shit.
Yeah.
Like, it's a guarantee that it is going to tank. It's going to be absolutely awful.
Yeah.
And once you've announced it, it's done. Solo, huge example. Den of Thieves, huge example. Like, if you say it's inspired by heat, you've blocked yourself.
But every movie basically gets sold in Hollywood. There's always something meets something.
Something.
Yeah, Infinity War? Didn't they give Infinity War some obnoxious, like, it's... Or was it The Last Jedi was like, Bridge Over the River Kwai meets something, and you go, just stop it. Stop it.
Lunatics.
Film nerds.
Question is, what is heat?
Heat
is something made something.
Yeah.
What is heat? Well, that's a good question.
Started to coin one, which is like, it's like if Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid had the guys following them had their own whole story.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm. And you brought this up on a recent...
Recent episode, which is like, you know, because I was curious about retroactively editing Heat as, like, Butch Cassidy and Sundance and having, like, just to see what it'd be like if there was a Wraith-like cop... or Wraith-like criminal, and you only got to see one side of it. You never saw it, but it's like, I imagine it's that, and then there's that entanglement that happens with Butch and Sundance, and love story, and like this hopefulness and things like that. And but it, you know, it's very myopic because it's eventually these two guys. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know, but you know, in this genre, like, there's another phrase that I, you know, I've used a few times on this show. You guys might have heard is I call them like genre ruiners. Like there are some genre ruiners that come along that are just so good that it almost like temporarily just like blows away a genre.
Yeah.
And so you think of like what The Godfather did to the gangster film genre for many, many years. It took to, like, you know, I think it almost takes to 1990 with Goodfellas before the genre like is revived. And then later on Sopranos as an example.
But that's not the way. Like Hollywood will always bring up something will break through in a genre that hasn't really had much success. Pirates of the Caribbean was like a very famous one.
Huge.
Gladiator was a big
Gladiator.
Famous one. Where it revives that genre. And for about a couple of years later, you get copies after copies and they just get worse.
Yes. And then eventually people have to reappraise the, like, you know, stick with the tropes and then do something else.
Yeah, but we go from Coen's True Grit to Magnificent Seven, that train wreck that it was.
Yes.
no actual training. Worse.
No.
God damn, True Grit's a good movie. The example, I'm just trying to think of what I was trying to do some live Googling here is... probably the French Connection in this genre. Heist, Heist is maybe, you know, the other big one. Dog Day Afternoon probably as a pure...
I still love Heist from Mammoth.
Oh, the Mammoth one.
Mammoth one is quite good. I'm just trying to think of what...
Oh, you mean something
like, yeah, like the
quintessential, or a Top Copy or something?
Yeah, like the quintessential heist movies that come around sort of generationally. Like,
I think you're talking about De Niro's The Score, directed by Frank Oz.
You know what?
I like The Score.
I like The Score. It even has disgustingly fat Marlon Brando in there.
Yeah, it's got... Who apparently wasn't wearing pants during
And it's Edward Norton. It's got the impression of Ed Norton doing his thing. I'm not going to do on the show because I'm going to offend someone. One, but it's you know, it's very good.
But I remember that came out, The Score and The Heist came out like within 6 months of each other. It's one of those versus sort of situations, you know. You had the ants movies and the media movies and all that kind of shit, and both of them were like really well liked.
Oh, they're very good.
I'd give The Score another watch. That was a fun movie. That was a fun movie. And so you
Angela
sort of
Bassett as well. She plays
De
Niro's girlfriend. Yeah. He's got the jazz
club. He owns the jazz club.
That's the most real life De Niro portrayal.
I always see that as like, you know, what may have been if it's as a sort of a, as we've, if you've said, like Insomnia is
100% is 100% a sequel.
And your boy Nolan as well.
You would have heard with the amazing Adam Frost on the plane. Nolan is like telling him all the secrets of Heat and going to make Insomnia the sequel. How dare you, Nolan? And he wanted the cocaine sniffing Vincent Hanna in that movie hard because that's the guy that goes and does something dodgy in a crime scene. So we have completely gone off track. We're at the 100...
You're breaking discipline. This is what happens.
This is what happens. We're at the 151st minute of Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus Heat. And if you don't know, as I sort of alluded to in the beginning, we're in the middle of the LA Hilton near the airport. And we've sort of seen in the last minute that I had these guys on, so very fortuitously we talked about Amy Brenham's character Edie sort of awakening from a dream. And in the preceding minute, the 150th, we actually kind of get to see that. And so you watch Neil McCauley come in, ingratiate himself into this hotel, change into a uniform that's on a rack, walk upstairs, hide from a concierge / shotgun toting undercover cop, and we begin this minute with Neil going upstairs in the hotel and beginning his infiltration to attempt to get Wango. So that's where we're kicking it off, and I believe that I may have to quote a Twitter DM between the three of us where Garth said it is exceptionally believable that this guy, the concierge, in LA is also a cop, because no cops can afford to live in LA. They always have to have a second job. So I'm sure we'll dive more into that in just a minute. But we're going to watch this minute together again, guys, as Neil ascends in this elevator up to slay the damn dragon of this movie. And then we're going to come back and talk about it with you.
Not moving. I'm staying here.
I'm checking the stairs. There's smoke. I'm pulling you out.
Your attention, please.
What about her dad? You want me to call him?
He's somewhere in the Sierras. And she chose you.
Somewhere in the Sierras.
Sierra Nevada, yeah. I'll let people go with it up there.
Now, one thing that struck me is we, last Friday, went to watch Alien and Aliens.
Yes,
we
did.
At the Ritz at Randwick.
It was a blast.
And on many things that happened on the drive home, which we're not going to go into, obviously, not in front of the microphone. But we did talk about...
That's not familiar.
Yeah, maybe. We did talk about the difference in disciplines between Alien and Aliens.
Mm. Yeah.
And the little touches, and man does it a fair bit in this, of just the occasional subtle close-ups.
Yes.
And we see at the beginning of this minute. I love, like, this, the use of the fire alarm, just as that way to sort of laser focus on what's happening. So everything we've got is, he could have been fine with just, he could have walked by and just pressed it.
Yes.
But I love the way, just again, we've commented, we've had a few minutes together where we've highlighted the editing in this, of just those little jumps.
It's a relaxed pacing kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, just those jumps to the little close-ups. Then we get the jumps to the elevator to show that it's happening. But it's just those nice little way, man, constantly just breaks it up with just a little visual flair. It's the same thing Cameron did in, you know, when Ripley's getting all gunned up and he just cuts to some of the close-ups of the ammunition.
Yes.
Yeah.
Doesn't need to. Like,
no.
She could sit there just feeding shells into a thing, but he just breaks it up for a second to just...
It gives it a little sort of tactile sense to the scene. Yeah.
And also, it's like...
We also have a fire alarm here with the glass that shatters.
And I love that from the sense of, like, it's like this experiential camera. It's because you're in a space and then they take you to where their focus areas are almost. Yeah. And then, like, you can do that in a really overt way. There's some great ones in Sin City with Robert Rodriguez, and there's some phenomenal voiceover with Mickey Rourke's, you know, that big, the big hulking dude who's, you know, hatchet. And he's like describing what he's taking with stuff and it's showing all on the screen. But in this...
It's interesting, like this shot here, where we have this shot of De Niro getting with his gun ready, and then the shot of the alarm.
Yeah.
Both from almost like a child's perspective, looking up.
Yes. Everything's looking up, and it's like, it's almost, that's what I mean by experiential. It's like, it's Neil glancing at things. You know
what I love it? And
I love the fucking, in this one, the tie clip.
Yeah.
He's got like, it's just like, he's so decked out perfectly. It's still Neil. He's not Russian. He's just like, making sure I'm all
well. Well, because he won't, again, like he, like from the very start of the film, he won't stand out when you're in a lineup.
No.
He'll just look, he has to look like everyone else. But I love the, how prepared he is. Does the field check of his gun. He's not like, he's going up there to do the business. And it implies, I know you guys have said maybe he's maybe ex-military or
definitely
something. Because he's got the tattoos.
Yeah, yeah.
We know Hannah's military. I'd like to think that he is.
Yeah.
Just the way he does that, of just checking the gun. So he's not getting up there going to, like, you know...
It would certainly explain so much of the character, of the discipline and
that
kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so we're here. He's I love... There is no one that I've seen do this. And I think... And in preparation for this minute, I just want to talk... How many people have you seen back themselves into the corner of the elevator? I thought about this because there's an elevator, several elevators at different work sites that I work at. And I'm like, I have never done what Neil does. And that is such an amazing touch. Obviously, it is, as far as symmetry-wise, like if we're talking about formal aptitude here, it's a very beautifully frame shot in the third second, if we just were freeze-framing here. Beautifully framed, looking up.
It's a pretty elevator.
Yeah, it's elegantly lit. And
for a Fred elevator.
And again, no qualms that Dante Spinotti is a master. He's lit this to perfection for this reflection, and it's all lined up from man and his camera operators. But yeah, the field check is in there, and that is like the total consummate professional tucked into the corner. His back is to the wall. The scenario, his back is to the wall.
Well, and you get the sense that it's so he's slightly concealed when he knows that when he opens up the top, if someone happens to be around the corridor, or he's tucked into a corner,
yes,
he's at least got a chance.
Yeah.
You know, he's got the extra jump on someone that he may need, especially if he's going into...
Oh, it begs to the, you know, it's like... I guess with spies and all that sort of stuff, that when they can walk into a place and immediately case where all the exits are, where all the things are, all the threats in the room, is that kind of thinking.
Yeah, we don't, and you know, we were robbed, no pun intended, of seeing how he got into Van Sant's, like up the hill.
Yes,
but he goes up so effortlessly.
Yeah,
he like
just
through a compound. So you get to this, like the foresight.
Probably climbed a cum tree, according to the last episode.
Exactly, and you get and to go downstairs and just play off systems as well. Like he knew when he was stealing the ambulance that no one would look at at that time you're going into a busy emergency room, no one's going to bat an eyelid at an ambulance officer or driver walking through. He knows this, that at whatever o'clock, if it's near, say
it's 10 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night,
anyone who's gets a call downstairs, they get the call and he's like, oh, they forgot to do it again. He says it so casually.
That's the thing.
And that's the trick.
If you go to many places, and I've, you know, in our jobs, we've been in a couple of places where you probably shouldn't have been, and just gone wandering. And if you walk in with enough confidence and enough just sort of relaxed, like you're meant, look like you're meant to be there, it's amazing how long you will get before someone stops you, or before you actually hit a roadblock where it's like, okay, now we have to.
Do you guys see Compliance? It was based on the true story about the guy who rang up the McDonald's.
Oh, no, I didn't
got them
see that.
To keep doing it, and it went up and up. And it gets to a point where you're like, okay, this is getting ridiculous. But it was apparently pretty close to the true story. Mm. But it's funny if you just... people want to sort of respond to some kind of authority or some kind of the system. Mm. So this, how he taps into, oh, yeah, they do it all the time. Oh, yeah, here you go. Because it's not out of the ordinary. It's him... you know, knows these systems. He's probably cased a hotel for a job before or something.
And yeah, like trying to rob something from a hotel.
Yeah.
But people also, you know, especially with that one where he's on the phone before he's checking, they know where the phone call's coming
from. Yeah, they're like, it's from inside the house.
People, there's not only the thing about, you know, the confidence system, people just believe enough in the system as itself.
Yeah, we're perfunctory.
It's, got its own protection. Yeah. Nothing on.
And you can play on that as long as you don't give them the excuse to go, who is this?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's what brought Han Solo undone.
I'm fine. How are you?
Too much bands.
Now, was this about C. Stewart you were talking?
Yeah, his name tag is C. Stewart.
Yep.
It was like K. Stewart, then you would have like all the Kristen Stewart fans just
K. Stewart.
And how's it? Is it UART?
No,
EW. The wrong way to spell it.
The wrong way. Sorry. And still looking very sharp. Gets his maglite torch. And we're about 17 seconds in the minute. He gets out on the 17th floor where he knows that Jameson, a.k.a. Wango, is. And boom, little pull the fire. We actually watch the glass break.
And here's the thing. This is where you can't really do this film anymore because, you know, this is 95, post, you know, 2001 and lots of stuff. Every elevator and almost every major hotel has, like, cameras.
Yes.
Especially both at the exit points and the entry points and within the things
and, some of the... And in 2019, some of the cameras have facial recognition.
Well, especially a fucking Hilton, which is like... they've had terrorist bombings.
And that was the funny thing. Speaking about heist films, I watched Caught King of Thieves. The Michael Caine one, about the London robbery. And it's all the old school crooks doing it.
Mm.
But it seemed, and I don't know if it was just exaggerated for the film... but when you layer on modern technology, they sort of clean them up in a lazy afternoon, just going bing, 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 bing. It's all on footage. It's this. It's capturing everything and rounding them up in no time because of the technology. That's what I love about this. Mm. These films of the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, up to a sort of a point before mobiles came in, before we sort of hit... when was Enemy of the State? Late 90s?
98.
Yeah, so that's when it started to turn and we were starting to do sort of bringing satellites into narratives and things like that. There's some mobile phones in this, but they're not, they're just perfunctory. They're not for really they're giving just exposition. They're not for doing
sort of surveillance culture. Yeah,
and now we have to have the we write into every horror film.
See how fast that was, 95 to 98. See how fast the transition.
Yeah, the tech is quick. I mean, I remember one of the beautiful things. If you go back and watch Alias, which is J.J. Abrams' first series, in the first season, there's like a character who's like the Q of the Bond movies. It's a gig. And he's geeking out about his latest invention, a remote modem, which is like about the size of a fucking brick.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like, oh my God, you can actually transmit remotely? Wow.
Yeah. It's kind of like even you look at like Casino Royale to Skyfall. Like even a couple of
That's six years. Yeah,
yeah, and it's already like more tracking things and more this and more.
And everything's going back. It's lo-fi, south to grid.
Well, that's
going the radio.
That's why you almost want films to be nostalgic for this period, so you can go.
We don't have the cameras in everywhere. You don't have the phones in everywhere. They interrupt everything. This is all those systems have grown exponentially every year.
Well, it's kind of like why Captain Marvel worked the other night. For a certain extent, like taking out certain technology is interesting because you got to find more interesting things for your actors to do in the space.
Yeah,
and you're not having to write silly ways of getting around, like blocking out the camera or I love that he takes a little pause
just to make sure
It's working.
Yes.
Because it's not going to screw up on his watch.
Yeah, and also he wants to see that the lifts are behaving in the way that he knows they're going to behave, which is that they're going to go down.
But he's so amped that he's just like, but I'm going to stop and get this right.
And so we can see all the other lifts are going down, which is, and it's again reinforcing in the message. Why did he stop to look at that? What was he doing? Now, I said in the previous minute, and I think it may have been shot in one sequence, but they've sort of deftly spliced in another quick view of Edie just to sort of see her starting to react to the external stimulus of, like, the hotel now has an alarm going off. Neil's walked in a few moments ago. Now the goddamn place has got an alarm and a fire alarm and people are spilling out of the building. So she's there and freaking out.
Mm.
And finally, we're like actually getting to see like this Wango as Jameson in this hotel has been talked about in this movie. And we're finally now like here at his door. We're not really, we haven't quite seen him yet.
Well, no, we got the monitor watching his door.
Yeah. We're at the monitor watching
the beauty, his door. I love this sort of, you go back there with the thing, they have this, the TV is tagged with property of LAPD. Yeah. You can tell like cops are like obviously taking.
But you'd be surprised how much stuff is lifted. On police property that there are things that you go, really? But and some poor schmuck has a job of going around to audit all those to make sure they've
sold. And look at how cool, we talk about like, you know, technology, just went on a technology tangent, but it's so pertinent and is still, you look 41 seconds into this minute, like it's a hardwired
phone,
mini camera on the phone into the viewfinder on the door, and like they've got like manual tape to like tape all this wiring up, like it's literally like this podcast studio right now.
Pretty much. And the full on like cop stakeout food with like the chicken on the plate. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, the goddamn chicken getting cold.
Are you familiar with Matt Gawley's podcast, I Was There Too?
No.
So the whole premise of the show is to interview the people, the smallest actors in the biggest films.
Okay.
So he interviewed Jeanette Goldstein came in for her roles in all the Cameron films.
Yeah, yeah.
He had the thing that kicked it all off was interviewing the woman who was pushing the pram in The Untouchables. So, or he got, like, for instance, he got the people on the bus in Speed.
Okay, yeah.
And they go through their backstories. Yeah, yeah. I always wanted you to get one of these guys.
I've been trying.
You go.
Justin Armour came on the show a long time ago and he gets run into by Al Pacino in an upcoming scene.
It'd be. Oh.
He's an extra. He got run into in this scene.
It's like.
Justin, if you're listening, hello.
It'd be interesting to see what their perspective on the, like, they probably, you know, how long they're there for, what they did, but these guys give it their all for their screen time. They really go for it.
They're literally here just to have this sequence and then to get beaten up by Neil's body. Yeah. Like, in a very, very close proximity. Yeah.
When you get someone from this film, you get the SWAT guard who, when he sits back and gets back. The triggers
Captain Hydration.
Yeah.
Captain Hydration. And you know about Captain Hydration? He's actually the son of an ex-president.
Really?
Yes. Okay. I'm going to find his name right now. Continue vamping for me, gentlemen.
Oh, okay, we'll do.
So that people can't.
So the cops are watching. The people are running out of the hotel.
But it's interesting again how he jumps from. another form. Like, to the way he breaks up from going from 80 to then jumping to looking through this monitor.
Yeah.
Again, he just has a...
Stephen Ford, sorry. Officer Bruce. Gerald Ford.
Jerry
son.
Ford.
Okay. Has been in Black Hawk Down, has been in Starship Troopers. He's been there in When Harry Met Sally, and in this movie as Captain Hydration, as dubbed by Joe Lynch.
Not a bad filmography.
So these guys are now looking over Wango's door. Like, I think it goes to exactly what you talked about, Stu, which is like, even way back when we were all together with Mr. Luke Buckmaster in those first opening heist minutes, and we were talking about the like encroaching geography of a scene, like it was this momentum towards a position. I think this is now like this really cool moment where we're seeing destination. It is almost like when we do pull, you know, when you see Treya pull up, or when you see the truck park under the bridge, or you see those things, it's like we're now seeing destination finally in this movie, and we're seeing where Neil's going. And all these points of like, you know, a smashing glass, so what numbers are going down, like we're finally here.
And what detail as well, like you say, with the chicken there on the like the room service, the cup.
Mm.
Again, knowing man's preparation, he's probably made these guys sit in there for 2 days
to get it does comfy. Look like a room like, has been like well used. And
it
abused.
Looks like you can almost taste the smell of that room. Like there's a,
well, you yeah, can generally. Yeah, I mean, yeah. this is a Hilton airport hotel.
Yeah.
The only things that happen at airport hotels are generally fucking or sleeping.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And that's just the staff.
Yeah.
That's not even the guests.
Well, you know, if I found the staff in those hotels, I shouldn't have.
What a way to break this up as well. Like,
you have the hospital suit.
Yeah, yeah, but this sort of... It is the
nicest hospital foyer I've ever seen.
But this weaves as well when you're... Why are you taking us back to the... Like,
the momentum has built to such a like relentless pace there, and you're like, oh, God, he's going to get him. Yeah. And then he just goes,
he's in
nope.
He's tension in the
diffuser.
House.
Yeah,
a nice tension diffuser of us taking us back to the fallout of Lauren.
And again, the payoff for us is going to be when he ups and runs down the stair to get him back in the game.
Yes.
Like, because at this stage, he's so checked out. He, you know, it's like if you asked him who Macaulay is now, he'd barely be able to recall much of the case. As far as he's concerned, it's over.
Yeah.
And then all of this happens.
He's already checked out, yeah.
The, you know, we get some excellent chewing. Here's the gum from hell, the most chewable gum in college.
And I don't know what color is those couches? Evergreen.
What color is he? What color is the tan that he had applied to him?
I don't know.
He looks like a crocodile that's been sunbaking. What's going on?
He's Italian. They have good tan.
Beautiful that's, Italian.
That's,
olive
look
skin
at
man.
That. That's not. That is not. That's tan. That's almost boot polish that's around him. Look at that.
Not.
Come on, copper tone was big back then.
Yeah.
And listen, and you know what, gentlemen? I just forgot. You know, we talked about the people who are preceding you. We're right on the precipice of the great Pasquale Buber's favourite minute of this movie.
That's because I think that's where I'm getting the chewing from, was because you left a little snippet of that out before of him talking about chewing
that gum. God damn it, Diane Venora was beautiful right then. She's a stunner. And I think I like her so much more because she's just... In the last time that we were together, we were talking about... You know, really being conflicted and feeling significant discomfort thinking about Edie, and we really talked the ins and outs of agency. And you get this wonderful moment with like Diane Venora, and you're like, she's just so goddamn likable. She's just so goddamn likable because she's just blousy and she challenges Vincent. And I think the women in this
it's a very interesting, very mutual kind of equal relationship. Yeah.
What she goes with in this final sort of half an hour of the film, from the breakup. From like the Ralph breakup to the incident with Natalie Portman.
I think you've been Ralphed needs to be something. Can we just agree if your ex does it,
Ralph?
As our friend Lawrence Barber said on this thing, is like, we don't know what she and Ralph got up to, but he wanted to get out of there.
Yeah.
she's like, as I said before, she could be, she would totally, you know, I know a couple of people who run not brothels, but the kind of, you know, the S&M palaces where they do, people go for, you know, just get a
little bit of
whip and snip.
No, wait, slow, whoa.
She would be
Oh, you mean
pump
like
the brakes, Macaulay?
Oh, you mean like Jerry's place? No, sorry, don't have a place at the top of my head where I can go to.
But she would be a great, like, you know, sort of madam that runs one of those places. If she has that kind of
I'm still getting my head around the need for one of those places. I'm not begrudging anyone that needs one. I just don't have one in the Rolodex. No, been there.
It's LA. Everyone
yeah, oh, okay, sure. I thought you were about to, like, hand out a coupon code or something. You know.
I do have a discount if I need.
Literally, just when you thought you'd heard everything that Garth could say on this show.
I think there's more coming.
There's more.
I think it's like in the...
It's literally my favourite thing about being his friend. It's like I never know where it's going and I'm so happy.
The Ralph thing is like the baller way to do the breakup as well.
Yeah.
To go, not only are you cheating on me, I've got the best line of, like, you know, I do what I say and I say what I mean and all that sort of stuff. And then to go off at Ralph and take the TV, it's like... I don't know if you caught Liam Neeson's... Did you catch Cold Pursuit?
Yes. Oh, no, I haven't seen it.
Oh, okay. Well, like, in it, someone... I'll just... Without going into too many spoilers, but there's a great thing. Someone leaves a note to someone in order to do a breakup, and it comes in a plain white envelope, and they open up, and it's a plain white card, and when they open it up, it's empty. Just a plain white. And I'm like, that is the most baller way to do a breakup. Like,
you're not even worth it.
I've got nothing to say on this girl, but you took the time to open it. I was like, I'm tempted to, like, derail my current relationship
to have that much hand, as George Costanza would call it.
I'm just so glad this isn't being recorded.
You're a sadistic man, right?
Yeah, but I'm not wrong.
You'd be great for one of those S&M pillows.
Hell, hook a brother up.
We'll do.
I think Dark Horizons would be a good name for it. You get a sponsor of gear. Or cinephiles, who knows? Maybe that's Tuesday nights there.
Tuesday nights at Dark Horizons cinephiles.
But she's so good here. Like, this, the way she's sort of gone from so cocky during the Ralph thing.
Yeah.
In that sort of, like, it's the child that, like, purposely breaks the thing and then waits for the parent to get angry. She's gone, look, what have I got to do? I'm going to throw in the pathetic yoga pant wearing towel, which is Ralph. And then she's doing the thing. It's the brashy statement.
Ralph, settle down!
Doing the brashy thing to then... The look she gives him in the emergency room Natalie Portman's on the bed and she's like, I finally get this cop stuff.
Yes.
Like, yeah. I see the stuff why you're not coming home and talking to me about it.
Yes.
And I think that carries through to this scene where she's looking at him, snuggled in, like they just had a divorce. His body language couldn't be colder.
Yes.
Like, he is almost perfunctory at this stage going, don't want you to get the... Don't get the thought for a second that I'm back. Like, he's like, they're there. Like, I'm going to get you through this and I'm going to be here. But he's sort of chewing the gum, more or less like marking time. Like, how long, like, the engine's starting to rev up about, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But then, and her just looking that look like, and then when it goes on to be like, do you think we could do this? And I love the way he's like, he can't say no. He's just like,
just like you said.
And it's funny, it's that way of, like, using the, remember when you called me a bad guy? I'm pulling that in now. I'm using your own words against
you. Here's an empty card.
Yeah.
That I didn't write it.
But, yeah, she's got a real power.
She's a magnetic presence. It's like there are three women in this movie and they're all very quite different, especially in terms of how they handle the relationships and so forth. And whereas you have Annie Bremen, who's almost like a very much a younger girl than she normally
is. I would describe her as being quite meek.
Yeah. You again.
Deep callbacks. 20 episodes ago. Callbacks on the show. Strong.
Really you have strong. The sort of weird differing levels of codependence and different levels of emotional investment in these sort of things. And this is probably the most equal and, I guess, adult satisfactory kind of relationship of the whole three. Major ones, anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, well...
Well, Chris, Charlene and Neil have this weird equilibrium, if you like.
Okay, Judd and De Niro.
Judd and De Niro.
They have an understanding, yes.
They've got like an understanding.
They know where the boundaries are.
They know where the boundaries are, and but in their relationship, there's the same sort of equality of, you know, agency as there is between Justin and Vincent. And it's strange because they're not having a loving relationship. It's Neil trying to control the crew, and he's using Charlene to control Chris, in essence.
She's more of a guy.
But Chris is also, something of a train wreck of himself. Chris is basically cleaning up his mess.
She's cleaning up his mess. Yeah. She's the stability that Neil needs Chris to have.
Well, Chris is like a second child, really. Yeah, like her, she's raising him and Dominic.
Yeah.
It just happens that he's good.
You know what? You're just a child growing older.
That's it. Mm-hmm. But this is, this is a little bit of intimacy for them in what is the death rattles of the relationship.
Mm.
Like there is no coming.
No.
There's no coming back. And I don't think, I mean.
But she's also someone who you would think, the character is someone who would be ultimately fine with that.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Yeah, she would. And she's also
she's a pragmatist.
In this moment of desperation, and I think she knows that it's there, she's just like, not to tread too much on the great, you know, the great Pascal Boo who's coming up, like in the next scene. But, you know, in the next scene, there's a wonderful moment where he goes, you know, he says, "All I am is what I'm going after." You know, you're right. All I am is what I'm going after. And it's like, he gets a beep and she goes, "You need to go." And Diamond Aura just does this maneuver where she kind of like straightens up her posture and she kind of like cleans the tears that are rolling down her cheeks and goes, "Yeah, I'm going to be okay.
I got this.
Jesus, Father."
And she is just, there's a metal that is in her character that it just reeks in the rest of her performance.
It was sold to her by Neil McCauley. you pondered in the last minute we spent together,
lady,
about
who do you care
about?
What I am, what I do.
Amy Brenneman's sort of relationship history. You get the sense that Justine has pissed off people. She's got pissed off and walked out of several.
Oh, I have no doubt. She's the one that's broken up.
Hit this wall with so many people.
Yeah.
She finally hit someone that she can't break because he's not there, and he's not emotionally invested enough to be like be a combatant that she would probably need the back and forth.
She didn't even break his TV.
No.
It's almost nigh unbreakable television.
Oh my life! Oh, so that was a bit too much Columbo. But no, there's something about there is a real power to her, as much as there is this sort of silliness to her as well, in that sense that she is a bit bratty in this. She's a bit sort of, why me? Like, to bust his balls when he's like, obviously come home from work. Like, this is not a 9-to-5 guy who's gone out drinking and is rolled in. This is a guy who's obviously,
who works very odd hours, long hours.
But if he is really out late, it's not for a good reason. So it's not like he's out coming in wiping lipstick off the collar. Like he's
no, he's
and then
out
she's like,
no, that's Den of Thieves.
Yeah, exactly. But then, like she, because again, the whole chicken scene, I still think is really interesting in this, that it sums up, it's sort of a nice bookend to this sort of relationship that I think this is what Justine wanted, this closeness and this being there.
She wanted to understand it. She was like, you know, you talk about people talk, you know, from a really boring perspective, is like, you know, people have different learning styles, you know, or you know, audio visual, like, or kinesthetic. It's like with Justine, she was never going to be able to hear him talk about it and understand, even though she was like, that's what she felt like she wanted as far as attention, how she felt love. But in this moment, she's like, literally, you know, for better or worse, is kinesthetically, like, she's literally nearly tasted how the experience of him like bringing in Lauren, giving instructions, saving a life, like, you know, stabilizing a patient and making something happen. And it's like, this is just something that was never going to be in her wheelhouse. It was never going to exist. And now in that moment, there's this fleeting glimpse of what their relationship could be, but it's all
burnt to the ground.
She did the great... I mean, Vincent burnt it down prior to that. Like
Vincent laid the fuel. She lit the fire.
She lit the fire with a napalm.
But also, he's left. That's why he's on the...
Hey, Ralph was the kindling.
He's on the downhill of a marriage. His third.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like that. He's burnt
out. How many marriages has Justine had?
That's a good question. I don't
know. Well, that's two at least. Him and the ex.
The ex with the...
So you...
Is it three for her too?
I don't know. Good
that's thing. The father.
Her husband's dead tech postmodern bullshit house.
And that's her third. Well,
no, maybe thing, it's her second.
Yeah, because you get the sense it's Lauren's dad, and she's what, about
12?
So you get the sense she's he's been out of the picture a few years. You get the sense they've been there for a while, but
And she's at the house.
So maybe that puts her at about sort of mid-20s when she marries. So there's a chance she wasn't married before.
But do you think also age is a factor in this case? Whereas, you know, in her case, she's probably the oldest of the three women in there.
Yeah.
That plays a huge part. She's easily the most mature.
Age-appropriate.
Yeah.
Age-appropriate for Vincent in this.
Oh, it's actually an excellent in terms of like an adult relationship in these sort of movies where so many of them cast so much younger with the women and that kind of stuff, especially in 90s movies.
But really, she's
and
got
here it's like, it's actually really like a nice coupling. It's like right on.
She's
and
got no choice but to straighten her. Like, she's got no choice but to say, I'll be okay, because the fucking daughter who I've overlooked is downstairs like at death's door.
But she has been medicating a lot of cases. And medication, people who do that sort of medicating a lot.
Yeah, but she's also
just suddenly have like a lucid moment where it's like, oh my god, I gotta get around.
She's also been smoking a lot of weed as well.
Yeah.
So she's been doing, she's been booming.
Shagging a lot of Ralph.
Yeah, exactly. That Ralph, once he get hooked.
Xander Berkeley in a loose fitting jumper and terrible tracky pants.
Again, what's it with this film and dudes like not appropriately? Like, they shouldn't be, like, the guys that should be watching sport are watching sport. Ralph and Van Sant have no business watching play. I think Ralph's watching the Lakers, and it's like, he's got no business
watching. At least he's watching a geographically relevant sport.
Yeah.
Van Sant's even more, like, weird and douchey and
it should have been
yuppie.
Van Sant, you would think, is like, he's watching these sort of movies, he'd be like, no, he wouldn't be watching hockey.
He should be watching the equestrian.
Like, yeah, he'd be watching equestrian or listening to classical music, or almost like a Bond villain kind of thing.
Ralph should have got touched up.
Touched up?
No. I think getting a dressing down, from Vincent like that is just such sublime. It's sublime. It's sublime.
One day, I hope there's a VR experience.
You get dressed up
where you get to be Ralph, and you go to get up, and he just yells at you in the manner of Heat. It'd be beautiful.
Well, that's the beauty of that scene. It's like, it's not that he gets angry at Ralph. He's just talking fairly calmly, and then like he'll shout, but not at the things you expect him to be shouting.
No, but also like,
but it's like yelling, but not yelling. But he's saying, Ralph, sit down.
But he's also doing a thing of instantly controlling a situation where he can abuse. Like, we've seen him do it the whole way through. He only goes off at the vulnerable people. He never yells at anyone with
he
doesn't do anything to Neil. He doesn't do anything to his crew.
That's a very male thing, though.
Yeah,
you
of
see
course.
It with a lot of guys where
it's just a dominance.
They'll immediately see it with men. They'll either be someone who they see as a subordinate, or someone who's like a peer equal, or they defer to.
Yeah,
or shaming in front of the
pack. But Vincent has a hierarchical approach to the way he appraises criminal informants, because he calls them all rats. Like, even though they're doing him a favor necessarily, he calls them all rats, and he treats them like rodents. Like, and with Ralph, I think it's him relinquishing his pressure. Like, it's like he's trying to control that situation to have it off with Justine, because he actually wants to have an argument with Justine. He's like, I'll go. No, Ralph, sit down. Like, I've given you an instruction.
No, but there's also a bit of it. It's like, you I'm not, like, I'm not, I'm going to rub your nose in it.
Yeah,
Justine,
stay here.
You're going to stay and play happy home, because that's what you want. Because,
Yeah, you stay here because, you know, everything that you guys have just done is cool.
But, and this is then such an interesting way then to come back to this, of just how quiet and a moment it is, especially when we've just left.
Frantic
action.
But again, this was frantic. It's like the contrast of these different scenes when you see, you know, the and in our previous minute that we discussed in 130, you saw the fallout of, you know, the facade of fantasy Neil to reality Neil, and then that pivots immediately, you know, after Neil sort of standing there in the smog in LA, that pivots to the Ralph scene. You get like these 2 minutes of this, you know, very, very candidly, you know, destruction of relationship that only sort of escalates with that Ralph sit down moment. Most of it's like, aren't you angry? And he's like, yes, I'm very, very angry, Ralph. You know, like he literally says, I'm very angry.
Yeah. But the strange thing is, we get, as much as we get Macaulay's decline here, we get actually the rise of Pacino.
Yes.
Of Vincent.
100%.
Because we get him, yes, he yells at Ralph, it's comical, but
he takes himself out of the situation. Like, it's
obviously... Yeah, he doesn't do the bad thing. He makes the right choice.
Yeah, but it's obviously a place of angst, and he's not good for him or Justine or the daughter. Like, it's actually become a negative spot, and he's been bringing that home. He's been bringing his work home and not... Like, the deal should have been that he leaves it at work.
Yeah.
And burns it off somehow before 100%. He comes in. So he does the thing of, like, taking it away, getting himself out of the situation.
Yeah.
Then comes storming to the rescue here and is boom, 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 making it happen. But again, it's another good thing. Then he's back comforting her where he can. So you actually see the rise where McCall is going off the deep end back. It's just interesting how they both come out of the heist going different ways.
Going
like,
in,
and really, like, because I'm not like he was on his way down on it, but he was enjoying, I think, like, you know, he mucks around in the house when he has the fight with Justine and then just goes and plays helicopter and goes and finds. So he's relishing the fact that he's got a house there.
Well, he seemed like he wasn't caring.
Well, he was sleepwalking through it.
He was sleepwalking through it. And also we were watching Vincent make big risky plays, so to speak, and a lot of them are coming off wrong.
Yeah.
And so now what we're actually seeing is Vincent being, for a large proportion of everything up until the Lauren scene, he's like, he is ahead. He's like 8-9 hours, Neil's gone. Like, he's like, so he's making all the moves. What we've got to do, we've got this born again new citizen. You know, he's getting information. He's planning the sea with Wango. He's trying to ensnare him. They've got Drucker down there in Venice Beach trying to catch Chris. Like, in his mind, there's a lot of maneuvers that are ready to come off and a lot of traps that are ready to be triggered. And we've seen him be very competent up until this point. And even now in what seemingly failure, him relinquishing the fact that, like, oh, shit, these guys are gone. He's had to really turn up again and be there and be there in a really humane way for this poor little girl who's sort of stuck in this situation as well.
And as we saw in the last episode, and you've said several times on the show, that's the beauty of the 3-hour runtime, that you can take the time to be only 90 seconds total of their exchange here.
Yeah.
But the impact of that and slowing the film down to let everyone catch their breath. It does it so well, the ebbs and flows and the just, all right, everyone get settled. We're going to go back to Wangro. We're going to get there for that.
But a key to that with this scene is, which we haven't discussed yet, was the music.
Yes.
The music and that stuff with the heist, that with the violin sort of really fast. And then you have this quiet scene where it's all relaxing and then, because of that cue, when it starts up again with the Wangro stuff, you immediately go back to that pacing a lot faster than had it been.
Like coaches you what particular heart rate you need. It's like interval training or something. Yeah. You're doing a sprint and then you're walking and then you're sprinting again.
Pavlovian heat response to it.
I've had this thought that maybe this movie has ruined me for other movies in some ways because there's such a level of artistry and command of so many things, one of which is, you know, that is often ruined in movies and can be really jarring and distracting, is like just overwhelmingly bullshit music choices, like dumb needle drops, really overwhelming scores that are trying to manipulate your emotions. And if it's incongruous with the filmmaker, like, you know, Spielberg's like Capra, so the music doesn't necessarily bother me in a Spielberg movie, even when it is trying to manipulate my emotions. But like the music in this, and especially the choices to have as little music as you need in this movie, in this epic, you know, so many spaces where it's quiet, so many spaces where you can ingratiate yourself into it just very naturally, waiting room ambience bullshit noise like there is here in a conversation happening, and then back to the high tone pacing, like the cleverness of that. You see so many films that just don't have that same
music. Is like visual effects. It's one of those things where it should be used judiciously. And the best kinds are the ones where you almost, it doesn't call attention to itself, but it's there and it knows how, when to play and when to be used just right.
Yes. And it feels like it's one aspect of filmmaking that the artistry is not always evident of late. There hasn't been.
Especially because so many scores are so interchangeable.
And they feel so digital. The way they don't have.
Yeah, that's why the scores, like Nicholas Britell's score for If Beale Street Could Talk, and then if you go back to The Phantom Thread and you hear Johnny Greenwood's score for The Phantom Thread, you're like completely mesmerized.
And then the other flip side is like a Giacchino or whatever his name, Michael Giacchino. And then who we just, the one we just lost, that was with Villeneuve, the Joseph, was it Joseph Johanna? He was doing some, and who's that? There's the other one that does Desplat or whatever, does the quite the moody sort of stuff.
Yeah, Displat's okay. I find Displat a bit odd.
Yeah, Displat's, he's gone off a bit. Who's the one that's the Mad Max guy that he's on everything now?
Oh, Junkie XL.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's Junkie XL. A whole bunch of scores now.
But they're very, I mean...
That's like Hans. But Hans Zimmer is like the quintessential sort of, here's my score!
Yeah. I just think...
Hans Zimmer just need. I want Hans Zimmer in just the jockstrap conducting.
Yeah. You
know, that's that's the thing with Hans Zimmer. I mean, those are the scores that, you know, drag attention to themselves. Well, but they are good scores.
I think if you ever listen to a decent breakdown of sort of what Williams does, and we've gone away from that of assigning, especially it helps with these big epic sort of films.
But that was always the way. Especially the 80s to early 90s, it was always the duo. It was always Williams or Jerry Goldsmith.
But
and they were the two that dominated scores for everything.
Williams would have assigned themes to people. To characters. Oh, yeah. Whereas others do... They do the scene, not the character, per se.
Yeah.
And so you then have the
sweeping... And that's why Spielberg has such an affinity for Williams, because he does it for character.
Character reason. And I think it sort of works in this, because we're getting... When that is that sort of quick and pace, the frantic nature of Macaulay, as opposed to this is this is downtime now. This could, you know...
Completely
and,
down.
And this is when... This is where the sort of starts to play a little too much with time in terms of how much is sort of... evaporated it throughout the night, but that doesn't matter too much, because you get these great moments where it has a timeout and takes a breath. So no, it's a lot goes on in this minute.
It's a stacked minute over two locations and two completely different moods, like massively different moods in what we're seeing. And look, just before we wrap up, we can unequivocally say that we haven't gone for the Travis Woods hour and 22 for a single episode record. I don't think we need to. No. I think you guys have done enough yards on this podcast and said enough things about it.
We could have. We're not doing it because we don't
want to. Do you want like a half-hour breakdown of the S&M Palace?
Why do you need to even ask?
Do you even know him?
I want you like Noonan, just to have the blueprints. And then when I question you, you just go, these things come to me. They're in the air.
I know how to grab it.
Yeah.
I know how to grab it.
I see a whip on the wall and I just know how to grab it.
I'm not an expert at these things. Come on.
Sure. You're no expert, but you'll have a look. That's the spirit.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been another episode of 1 8 Minute that has ended in a spectacularly different way than I expected that it would end. This is the 151st minute of Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus, Heat, and we are only
12 minutes. What are we, 15 minutes short?
15 minutes away from credits.
Time stretch.
15 minutes away from credits.
What else is... Then there were 15. And that's like the end of the thing.
These two gentlemen sitting in front of me and the, unfortunately, not here with us tonight, Mr. Luke Buckmaster, recorded the first 15 episodes of the podcast with me. And so we only have 15 to go, and only 14 of them don't have Michael Mann on them.
Yeah, it's funny.
Mm.
One of them will.
One of them will.
And in fact, I don't even know if that's the case, but...
No, it's been put into the universe.
But I'm throwing it into the universe so strongly that even if I have to cut up answers from other interviews he's done that are on the internet, he will be on this show. There'll be a Michael Mann soundboard.
It's like the Michael Mann, like Max Headroom kind of thing.
And if Michael Mann's not on this show, we'd like to know if he's seen The King of Comedy.
Because
there may be some similarities. And it might be 1 heat minute all the time. So we'll see. We'll see how that turns out.
I've got a
cheeky veiled threat service to me.
I've got a spare 70s talk show set in my basement. I'm ready for that very scenario. Ladies and gentlemen, I've been Blake Howard, as always, at Blake is Batman on Twitter, and I have Stu Coote, a member of the Cinephiles, and geekofoz.com, Stu_watches on Twitter, and Mr. The man behind Dark Horizons, Garth Franklin, who is at Dark Horizons on Twitter. That's where you can find us. Thank you in person once again, sir, for our web design. Bless you. Thank you, Mr. Paul Davies, for our music theme. And we'll catch you on another episode of 1 Heat Minute just around the corner. And you never know, just around the corner, you might be wearing shitty yoga pants.
Sit down.
When you need
need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.